Hello and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to our special series on my PhD thesis. So last time we were introduced to prestige and Disraeli's utter obsession with it, we saw the emergence of the Eastern Crisis and the inner struggle between traditionalism and Palmerstonianism 2.0 in the Conservative Party. We saw Disraeli forge ahead as the situation outside Constantinople deteriorated. I should note that if you're hearing this part of the story for the first time, we have covered this period of history before in our Britain Goes to War series, which is quite different from this series here, and it was made in 2016, so be gentle. But it does ground you in this era, and it provides a load of context. So if you're interested in that, that's some further listening for you. Of all the chapter ideas I moved around, cancelled or returned to for this thesis, this chapter here has always been there. Sometimes it was in the middle of my timeline until it floated to the end, and eventually it was my closing chapter. I think it's probably my favourite chapter because prestige seemed to have been on everyone's lips at this point. But I'd love to know so far what your favourite chapter is, if you have one. Answer in the Patreon post or elsewhere, and I'll say hi. Today we unwrap the Eastern Crisis more extensively and see how its key events were framed through prestige and Disraeli's determination to have a leading role. However nuts his colleagues may have believed he was, Disraeli's sheer tenacity did mean that Britain played a leading role in the conference and managed to roll back the clock on Russia's gains. The triumph was reminiscent of Palmerston's resolution of the Eastern Question in 1840, where he oversaw the Russians remove their controls over the Black Sea. The Tsar didn't go this far in 1878, but it was still quite a turnaround for a Prime Minister slowly sinking in a sea of opposition. Disraeli's objection to being excluded from the original Treaty of San Stefano was also reminiscent of French outrage at their exclusion in 1840. So yeah, history is weird. Without any further ado, I'm sure you're ready to get into this. So let's do it. I will now take you to March 1878. British prestige and Russian triumph. On the 3rd of March 1878, Russia dictated the Treaty of San Stefano to the Ottoman Empire. Although its terms were kept secret until late March, Britain had clearly been excluded from its negotiation. The Times reported on a Russian fear that Britain would form a close alliance with Austria and engage in a war for the humiliation of Russia and the recovery of British prestige in the East. It warned that those who believed the Eastern Crisis could only be solved through war would find much in the present juncture to confirm their prejudices. Indeed, to Disraeli, Britain's exclusion from the secret treaty was intolerable, but his stance also boasted a precedent. The Treaty of Unkiar Skelessi from 45 years before had roused similar anxiety and suspicion of Russian intentions and, as seen in the assessment of the 1840 Eastern Crisis in Chapter 1, France objected to its exclusion from a multi-power treaty which ended the conflict between the Ottoman Sultan and his Egyptian vassal. Contemporaries then feared that France might make war to recoup the prestige it had lost, since, unfortunately, the French were very nice and touchy on points of honour in matters of this kind. 38 years later, Disraeli assumed the French position, espousing a similar determination to address British exclusion, particularly where Russia, like Egypt in the 1830s, undermined the status quo without British input. It was also reminiscent of Britain's exclusion from the conclusion of the transformative Franco-Prussian War, for which Gladstone had been criticised. If the British people could have been furnished with a backbone, claimed one contemporary, Bismarck never would have managed such a transformation of the status quo. Kenneth Byrne assessed Disraeli's stance in the context of over a decade of British non-intervention, hidden under a cloak of timidity and inaction, which arguably began following the collapse of British policy in the Schleswig-Holstein crisis. For those that wished to rectify these errors, some Conservative colleagues believed that Derby's enthusiasm for non-intervention occasionally went too far. Clarendon urged that while the policy of not meddling is of course the right one, it was not necessary that all mankind should be let into the secret twice a day. By consistently expressing an unwillingness to fight, how could Britain's rivals believe in her power? In Derby's defence, Gladstone would later point out that from 1830 to the happy reign of Dizzy, the Tories had traditionally been the Pacific Party, and it was the Prime Minister, not the Foreign Secretary, who had gone against established conventions. In his assessment of Home Secretary Richard Cross's role in the Eastern Crisis, F.J. Dwyer opined that Disraeli's policy was one of opportunism based on considerations of prestige. Gorchakov, the Russian Chancellor, also understood that Britain would like to re-establish its prestige on the ruins of our consideration, and on the 6th of March he wrote to Ambassador Shuvalov to the effect that the hostility to us is growing, and it is no longer interests but questions of amour propre, self-respect, and prestige that are at stake. We shall remain polite and conciliatory in form, but firm in substance. Gorchakov reminded his ambassador that in 1871 we agreed to give London the satisfaction of saving its amour propre. Today, after a bloody and victorious war, we could not debase the dignity of Russia before the prestige of England. While San Stefano's terms were brought to the Tsar, rumours percolated that Russia had resumed its advance towards Constantinople. It is difficult to ignore the Prime Minister's sense of the public mood, which may have made him more supportive of a prestige policy than he otherwise would have been. Yet it would also be reductionist to discount Disraeli's ideological stance as mere window dressing. A committed imperialist, Disraeli may have identified prestige as a mobilising force which could direct united British opinion against Russian expansionism, both to enhance the empire's security in the East and restore Britain's reduced position in Europe. This gels with Bender Grosvenor's view that second only to Disraeli's yearning for prestige came his exaggerated fear of Russia. Yet it should be added that Disraeli's motives and ideology frequently left his colleagues mystified. These discussions on his sincerity notwithstanding, Disraeli was fortunate that British public opinion moved in his favour in spring 1878 as liberal morale plummeted. By mid-March, confusion and dissension over which stipulations Russia would submit to the proposed Berlin Congress moved the Times to discern that, according to one account, the Russians are holding out for fear that a too complete assent to the proposals of Europe should injure their diplomatic prestige, or in plain words, for fear of wounding their vanity. Of course, prestige was not considered a mere vanity project in Britain. By the end of March, the Times considered the victory of the Conservative candidate in the Worcester by-election as proof that the general position assumed by the government is approved by the country, and it added the claim that it is Russia who has trespassed upon the forbearance of England, a claim which the English public appeared to identify with. Blackwood's Edinburgh magazine declared it intolerable that Russia might be seen to resolve the Eastern question in its favour without consulting Britain. Yet the silver lining for Disraeli was that San Stefano had undermined Derby's role as a cabinet peacemaker. By March 1878, Derby's stance had become an inconvenience for a cabinet which wished to pursue a more confrontational policy. On the 22nd of March 1878, after several weeks of rumour, the terms of the Treaty of San Stefano were published in Russia's Journal de St. Petersburg. The Pall Mall Gazette could observe that since the treaty was now before the world, it was open to critique and interpretation, notwithstanding Russia's unyielding stance. These terms included an enlarged Bulgarian state extending into the Balkans with access to the Aegean Sea, an independent Montenegro, and provisions for such close Russo-Turkish cooperation that the Morning Post believed the treaty strikes at the Ottoman Empire root and branch and sets up the Tsar in place of the Sultan. Nor was this merely an ungenerous British interpretation, as one Russian negotiator claimed to Blackwood's that at a more convenient season, Russia may, by a single word or threat, without having recourse to arms, compel the port to grant the demands which will inevitably arise in the future. Foreign organs added to these unfavourable impressions, suggesting that British prestige had suffered a cruel wound and that the treaty had inflicted a blow to her prestige in the East. In response to the news that Disraeli would call up the reserves, Derby resigned as Foreign Secretary on the 28th of March. Salisbury succeeded him and within a few days had published his circular on the 1st of April 1878, in language singularly clear, dignified and decisive, according to the Pall Mall Gazette, creating a sense within foreign courts that Britain was willing to go further than mere talk. Derby's resignation was said to have made a profound impression, as foreign exchanges fell to a point lower than they have at any moment since the Crimean War, and war was regarded as almost inevitable. According to The Times, the publication of Salisbury's memorandum had the effect of completely transforming the aspect of the Eastern question. By the 8th of April, The Times reflected that the whole issue had been shifted by the Treaty of San Stefano, and now that it has become a question not of remedying Turkish oppression, but of tolerating Russian supremacy in the Ottoman Empire, it believed, the vast majority of the public adhered to the traditional policy of Great Britain. A striking claim, since the Conservatives' traditional policy was clearly absent, and by the middle of April, The Times commented on a strong feeling in both countries that war has now become inevitable, noting that Russian opinion believed England is determined upon a war, or on inflicting on Russia what amounts to a grave national humiliation. This was a striking change both in public mood and in the estimation of British intentions. By recasting his cabinet as willing to make war, Disraeli could potentially capitalise upon Russian concerns, thereby leveraging prestige as he understood it. The London Evening Standard carried reports from foreign papers which warned that a possible conference over the treaty's terms may be the last chance that favourable circumstances will give her of retrieving her prestige and vindicating her power by uniting her cause with that of all other nations. A possible solution was to harness Indian manpower to enhance British prestige and military standing. This possibility appealed to Disraeli because, as he explained to the Queen in mid-April 1878, after all the sneers of not having any great military force, the imagination of the continent will be much affected by the first appearance of what they will believe to be an inexhaustible supply of men. Indeed, the dispatch of 7,000 Indian soldiers to Malta sent a clear message. Buckle wrote that the Prime Minister established the principle that it is the right and duty of India to support, if necessary by military force, even in Europe, an imperial policy undertaken for India's benefit. That Indian troops could be used to bolster British security and standing in Europe, while simultaneously boosting British prestige within the Empire, was an additional bonus, though not without controversy. Moreover, employing Indian troops to protect British prestige arguably reinforced the idea that the latter could be affected by the diminution of the former, and this vulnerability would later be tested in Afghanistan. For a time, the move bolstered domestic confidence. On the 18th of April, The Times addressed the movement of Indian soldiers to Malta and warned that war with Britain would be an immense calamity for Russia, and asked, have they attempted to consider what another war would mean? It criticised Russia's obstinacy and bad diplomacy, urging her leaders to preserve peace by meaningfully submitting San Stefano's terms to a Congress. Among the advocates for this scheme was the Anglo-Irish statesman and writer, later Under Secretary for the Colonies, the Earl of Dunraven, who claimed in the Lords that with regard to our prestige in India, that must necessarily suffer if the impression were created in the minds of the people there that Russia was stronger in the East than England. Dunraven was echoed by the Earl of Aberdeen, who commented that when it came to the issue of Russian advances in Armenia, they could not help looking upon this question of Armenia in reference to our prestige in India. Fittingly, the Aberdeen Journal offered that English inaction had caused such a general belief in British cowardice that it was a common topic of serious conversation as to how long it will be before certain powers appropriate among themselves the commanding positions of Malta, Gibraltar, Aden, etc. While it was acknowledged that such claims were ridiculous, it was also conceded that the Bulgarian horror and neutrality agitation, which has paralysed the efforts of Her Majesty's ministers, has also inflicted for the moment a disastrous blow to British prestige in Europe. This interpretation of prestige would not have satisfied Disraeli's political opponents, including W.E. Forster, the Liberal MP, philanthropist, and later Chief Secretary for Ireland. Though Forster conceded the importance of preserving British power, he also insisted that the British Raj was itself contingent upon right and justice, and not by the prejudices or fears of our Indian subjects. If forced to depend upon its military power in India alone, what would become of our prestige? Forster asked, adding that if shrewd Orientals learned that British power was based in fear, then English prestige would be gone in India. Lord Hartington acknowledged that a large use has been made of the word prestige, and I fully admit its importance, particularly as far as Eastern countries are concerned. While qualifying that, when we speak of impressing the natives of India with our power, a reservation should be made as a condition precedent that the power should be used for objects which all the world approves. This distinction speaks to a wider degree of difference between how liberals and conservatives interpreted and deployed the rhetoric of prestige. Hartington elaborated how he did not believe that, in order to maintain our prestige among the natives of India, we should make an exhibition of our power in connection with objects which we ourselves should not deem it necessary to go to war about. Hartington insisted that the native princes are too clever to be misled by such a course of proceeding on our part, and he believed that if Britain were to use our power for objects we ourselves did not consider worth contending for, but which an Asian potentate might go to war to obtain, then it could be expected that this reduced standard of statesmanship would have a deleterious effect on Indian loyalties. Conversely, conservatives focused on prestige's power elements, pointing to grounds for anxiety over the impact a reduction in military force might have on Indian security. Salisbury clarified that he was not necessarily concerned at Russia's threat to India, but about the damage to England's prestige which might be done among her Muslim subjects by an unsuccessful Turkish policy. Some critics of the conservative interpretation of prestige were willing even to risk election prospects to make their challenge heard. At a meeting to present the Liberal candidate for North Ollerton, aspiring MP Albert Ruston professed himself against all wars for prestige, and the theory that it was a good thing to fight now in order to show that you are strong and in order to discourage people from attacking you in some imaginary circumstances of a remote future. A policy as foolish as it was abominably wicked. When, he asked, was our prestige higher than at the end of the Crimean War, when our enemy was utterly exhausted and our own resources still immense, yet within 18 months came the Indian Mutiny? Ruston pointed to Prussian triumphs after the Crimean War, asserting this showed that the strength of a nation depended not on prestige, but on its actual power to defend its interests when those interests were really attacked. Prestige, according to Ruston, did not dictate a nation's strength the same way that pure military power could. Neither could he admit that England had reason to fear any increase of Russian strength, or in any respect or in any part of the world to fear Russia. We were unassailable by Russia. This was an important addendum to the prestige ethic. Maintaining military power and engaging with responsible government, these liberals asserted, was the true method for upholding prestige, rather than Disraeli's fondness for display and involvement in foreign crises. It may be argued that the Times had not bought into Disraeli's presentation of prestige, since on the same day Ruston's speech was delivered, it commented on a sort of angry feeling that English strength is not appreciated abroad, that Britain must display its power in order to be feared, that Russia in particular has set us at defiance and should be taught reason or we shall lose our prestige in the world. The Times insisted that our power is so great and manifest that we may abstain from mere display, and that Britain could afford to suffer some loss of prestige or some appearance of its loss rather than incur the certain loss of a war, however successful it may be, if the war is otherwise without sufficient reason. And that Britain, as the foremost power of the world, should provide an example of forbearance and love of peace which will restrain the growth of the war spirit throughout the world. Could Britain not show the same forbearance she had shown to the United States in 1845 or to Spain in 1848? Contemporaries evidently disagreed, but as she had not drawn the sword, when Russia softened on the Congress issue, it enabled both liberal and conservative to feel vindicated in presenting their version of prestige. Russia's climb down was also aided by Salisbury's circular, a fact acknowledged by Joseph Chamberlain, who told the Commons that it constituted a new departure of the English government, because England had at last put forward European in place of British interests. By late May, indeed, this reorientation of interests enabled an exhausted Russia to give ground without too much loss of face, paving the way for a Congress 2 weeks later. The diplomatic victory may have been less impressive than it seemed, as scholars have attested to the weakness of Russia's position before the Congress met, owing to its diplomatic and moral isolation. According to the terms of the Congress of Berlin, 13th of June to 13th of July 1878, Britain ensured the temporary retreat of Russian influence from the Balkans, while gaining the island of Cyprus as a Mediterranean base. But Britain had also acquired new responsibilities, in the form of a guarantee of Turkish territory in Asia Minor. It was, in effect, a secret Anglo-Turkish alliance, a commitment of the sort which British policymakers had traditionally balked at. Leonard Courtney did not believe in the convention's sustainability and feared that the non-fulfilment of what we had undertaken would be a blemish on our honour. The opposition, and even some former Tory cabinet members, such as Carnarvon and Derby, prepared to attack on these grounds, while reserving some contempt for the claims of increased prestige. Derby added to this rhetoric, opposing the idea that we increase our power, our influence and our prestige just in proportion as we augment the number of our liabilities to foreign countries and as we extend the area over which our available resources are spread. Derby also doubted that the Anglo-Turkish Convention would be viewed as a positive contribution to British prestige. Others went further. Former Indian Viceroy Lord Northbrook addressed the view that the prestige of Russia will be increased by its Armenian acquisitions, while the prestige of England will be diminished, and this will be disastrous unless some means be taken to counteract it. Northbrook offered an antidote to Disraeli's version of prestige, reminding the Lords that the rumours and fears of Russian power are not new. Instead, as past British statesmen understood it, the Indian people would be impressed by the good government, the development of her resources, and the maintenance of friendly relations with our neighbours. By improving the lot of Indians, British security would simultaneously be improved, and her prestige would be sustained. Aiding this liberal presentation of prestige, the former colonial secretary Carnarvon believed that once the glamour which now bewitches men's minds has passed away, Britons would find themselves confronted with this most terrible and painful dilemma, either to carry through an almost hopelessly impracticable obligation or to retreat from it at the expense of national credit and honour. It may be argued that liberals fought against Disraeli's rhetoric by reiterating the traditional foundations of British honour, its maintenance of obligations. By enlarging these, the Prime Minister threatened the national honour even as he claimed to have British prestige at heart. Meeting this rhetoric, Disraeli proclaimed peace with honour after the Berlin Congress, and his colleagues echoed this sentiment. Others lauded the expansion of Britain's writ into Cyprus as proof of British power. Bismarck also concluded that British prestige had been restored by the act following many years of decline, though it damaged his own arrangements. The acquisition of Cyprus had not been carefully planned in advance, but those that supported it used the rhetoric of prestige as their justification. Conservatives also used the poor liberal record against them. Bailey Cochrane declared that if Gladstone had been in power, it was tolerably clear that the Russians would have been at Gallipoli and Constantinople and we should have to declare war in vindication of our honour. One could argue that the Prime Minister did not seek quarrels for prestige's sake, but that instead he would endure a crisis if prestige was perceived to be at stake. Bender Grosvenor noted that Disraeli was driven by an artificially high concern for the effects of events on English power, which he measured largely in terms of short-term prestige and honour. Although it horrified Derby and more traditional conservatives, prestige was one of the few consistent principles in Disraeli's foreign policy, such as it was, throughout his career. From the beginning of the crisis, Derby had lamented that to the Premier, the main thing is to please and surprise the public by bold strokes and unexpected moves. He would rather run serious national risks than hear his policy called feeble or commonplace. A feeble policy would never satisfy a Premier whose presentation of prestige placed such a heavy emphasis on power and intervention. Seton Watson's 1972 study suggested that Disraeli's actual goal was to make war on Russia for the purpose of bolstering British prestige in the triumphant aftermath. This was disputed by Milos Kovic, however, who observed, "The Prime Minister was fighting for prestige, fame and power. He was prepared to go to war, but he did not want it." By deploying Indian soldiers to Malta, Disraeli's aim was not provocation but deterrence. The threats were aimed at avoiding, not encouraging, war with Russia. The distinction is important. Rather than seeking war to increase British prestige, Disraeli wished to use the threat of war to demonstrate British prestige, understanding that tangible military power had to be present for this to be effective. It was thus critical to have Derby removed, to reverse the impression that Britain would not make war under any circumstances. Seen in this light, one is again reminded of Palmerston, who would use the apparent threat of war against France in 1840, Greece in 1850, or the United States in 1861, to acquire prestige without the cost of war. The pace of events aided Disraeli's position, because when the Russians retreated both before and during the Berlin Congress, British prestige was asserted before the world. Like Palmerston, Disraeli's contemporaries were also concerned that his belligerent policy could lead to disaster. Punch captured these sentiments with a cartoon that depicted the Prime Minister leading Britannia over a literal abyss and into war. But with the Russian war avoided, the prestige party was quick to rejoice in the aftermath of the diplomatic success at the Berlin Congress. The Morning Post noted that "these great ends have been attained not only without loss of honour, but by raising the prestige of Great Britain to a point at least as high as it had ever been before. Without firing a shot or shedding a single drop of blood, Britain managed to compel Russia, even in the moment of victory, to acknowledge the supremacy of public law and to relinquish no inconsiderable portion of the spoil which she had wrested from her vanquished adversary." This act of leveraging the mere reputation of British power to effect a favourable outcome at minimal cost could lead to only one conclusion. Britain's interests have been thoroughly vindicated. The prestige of this country has been raised, and the storm clouds of war which threatened to burst have been dispersed, as the Morning Post put it. But the alliance with Turkey was not as easy to defend. The former private secretary and biographer of Palmerston, Evelyn Ashley, insisted that by the Anglo-Turkish Convention, the government had completely parted with freedom of action and had handed over the national honour of England to Turkey. In response to the furor which followed from government benches, Ashley clarified that Turkey had now the power to ask Great Britain at any moment, however inconvenient, to do that which she could not refuse to do without the loss of national honour. Disraeli's supporters responded that British prestige was strong enough to preserve peace and prevent that nightmarish scenario from occurring. But, as the Eastern Crisis had demonstrated, British prestige was only as strong as the government was willing to make it. Fears that Britain would be dragged into another Turkish war by these obligations were palpable, but British attention was instead directed towards a different theatre when the Indian Viceroy Lord Lytton facilitated a new crisis in Afghanistan. Although confrontation over Afghanistan was not what Disraeli wanted. He became convinced that the Emir would have to be reminded of his place and of British prestige. Finally, British prestige had been affirmed and national honour was secure. Whatever we may say about prestige, clearly it aided Disraeli in his climb to the top of the greasy pole and then the peak of his popularity. Those few weeks in late July and early August 1878 may have been the triumphant high point of Disraeli's career, but they were bitterly short-lived. It is thus fascinating to see the sense of jubilation among conservatives when Disraeli returned from Berlin and his star was at its highest. Amusingly, MP William Cotton proclaimed, "Peace with honour used to be the incentive words for war. Now they were a sublime truth, an accomplished fact." Peace had now been restored and he unhesitatingly said, "A peace with honour," and he wanted to know why honourable gentlemen opposite did not put the pipe of peace between their lips and join us in the happy song. But the opposition were not interested in sharing what the Tories were smoking, and future Prime Minister the Earl of Rosebery complained that the arrangement to defend the Ottoman Empire in particular was mysterious and mystifying, adding that it was a proceeding, moreover, which he would take the liberty of saying was not characterised by the qualities which generally marked the course of British diplomacy. The Earl of Carnarvon also did not believe that Rosebery was far wrong when he described them as at variance with the traditional policy and feeling of this country. Earl Morley believed the convention had placed Britain in one of the most difficult positions ever occupied by this country. Not merely had we gained nothing, but we had gone in a precisely opposite direction. He challenged further, "Could we, when the honour of the nation was pledged, withdraw from the pledge? Parliament and the nation would support the course to which in honour we were bound," but he ventured to think that these treaties, agreed upon behind the back of our own and other nations, would impair the character for candour and openness which had hitherto distinguished English diplomacy and would create a precedent very dangerous in its results. In fact, history shows us that the Eastern question was effectively answered for the time being. This was the last war the Russians and Turks would fight against each other, at least until 1914. By then, this guarantee of Turkish territory would be long forgotten, and the Russian boogeyman would be Britain's uneasy friend. How impossible this must have seemed to contemporaries of this Eastern crisis. As Disraeli had proved, prestige granted Britain security and the respect of other powers. Now that she had resolved the Eastern question, where could these energies be directed next? Although the Russo-Turkish War was over, its consequences continued to ripple outside of its parameters, all the way to Kabul and then to South Africa. Having cultivated such grand expectations and proved Britain's prestige, so it seemed on the world stage, the grim reality of incessant colonial conflicts then loomed into view. Once more, India was in danger, and once more, Russian tentacles were to blame. We're, of course, going to examine this development next time, in a story that takes us beyond our Britain Goes to War coverage, so I hope you'll join me for that brand new content. Until then, I have been Dr. Zach. You have been a wonderful history friend. Thanks so much for listening to and supporting this show on Patreon. You are amazing, and I'll be seeing you all soon.